This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones are our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones out there that we cross and say hello to each other, talk about what's on our minds, and maybe marvel about the different kinds of people who live in our small towns. And maybe sometimes we imagine what it would be like to be transgender in a small town in North Dakota. That's the circumstance Grand Forks-based photographer and mixed media artist Beverly Poppy examines in her show, Trans Nodak. It's on display now at the Rourke Art Museum in Moorhead. Ashley Thornburg visited with Poppy at the exhibit opening.
What first drew you to the topic of transgender?
I guess a lot of what was going on in the media currently, just all around all types of art, film, other photographers who are dealing with it, with the issues, the politics that are current in today's society. I started the series over a year ago, so it was before President Trump was elected. And yeah, things just kind of evolved then with the president being elected. It evolved, yeah, all from there.
How did you find the people?
I found them incredibly brave to participate in this series, and I tried to get to know them through interviewing them, spending the short amount of time that I did photographing them, but then there were a lot of pre and post emails to get to know them more personally, and in particular, I had one friend who really, really helped me out with a lot of the terminology to correct me whether I was being politically incorrect and so forth.
I love your answer to that because, you take the word find and it immediately speaks to sort of the passion, the purpose, the intent of this project is to talk about people as people no matter
correct.
What.
Yeah.
And me, I was literally just thinking, where did you find them? Was it a Craigslist ad? was it through friends? That to me really speaks to just how ingrained your own message is in your mind.
Correct. Yeah. I had met a transgender individual who was my first subject, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. And then they led me on to a friend who is really, really in charge of the safe houses in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and she then put out a post to a bunch of her friends, and it just kind of snowballed after that. It kept going and going, and more participants wanted to be in the series, and that's kind of how it evolved. And then I ended up having, I think, 4 transgender individuals from Grand Forks, and then the other 8 were from the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Was it difficult in North Dakota?
Yes, it was. This state, I don't think is the most accepting state for transgender individuals that live here. I felt very passionate that I wanted to get all of the participants' voice out there.
Did you learn some of the background stories from some of the people in your exhibit? Teresa, Sid, Darcy, do you know a bit about them?
Yes, I do. Some I know better than others because of the communication, but we still follow each other either whether Facebook friends or through email. For over the past year, I've contacted them individually numerous times. So, yeah.
A photographer has a very difficult job oftentimes of getting the subject at ease because most people don't go around getting photographed very often. Did you find, for the most part, were people really nervous not opening up because this is a population that has just been horribly misidentified, misportrayed in the media? Or was it more like, no, I absolutely want a fair, positive representation out there?
Good question. I would say that with the 12 individuals that I did photograph, it was about half and half. I do particularly remember one participant being very uncomfortable with the photo shoot in regards to whether she was in a safe place. that ended up working through. She had other support system there to help her through the photo shoot. And then I remember another participant who came in and just was absolutely loved it. He was wanting to get into modeling. So it ranged from people who were very shy to people who were more than willing to be photographed.
How do you deal with both ends of that spectrum just as a photographer or subjects in general?
I guess you just take it in stride, depending on the situation. I'm very used to, with my background, my commercial and advertising background, with photographing celebrities and chefs and people from all over the world. So I'm very comfortable at a photo shoot setting. Part of my personality takes over, where I try to talk like how you and I are talking right now, one-on-one, where I say to my subject, this is just you and I, you can listen to my direction, and it's for a good cause, and hopefully you have fun. Most of all, have fun.
Well, let's go through the actual artistic process here of the print, because, you know, it was right away billed as a photography exhibit, definitely more of a mixed media exhibit. So just kind of narrate what your pictures end up looking like.
The process is where I have a lot of fun. So there's a photo shoot that takes place, but then the actual pieces themselves are digital tintypes. So it's a mix from the old way that we used to process photographs through a tintype. And from that, there's a clear transparency that I print a color photograph on, which is then transferred onto the tintype. Now, the tintype itself is aged in water over 48 hours, and with that, there's mixed media. There's objects that are laid on the tin. They age for a couple days, so in some of the pieces, you will be able to see that come through, and then there's also a lot of digital technical aspect to the actual photograph. Graphic design is involved, so if you look closely at each piece, you will see a date over the face, which is the date of where each transgender individual began to live their truth, and then really, really tiny text over the face, it's very repetitive, is the pronoun of their choice. So that's the digital print that was all transferred onto a clear transparency. Then that transparency was transferred to a tintype. I actually purchased the tin at a different location. I aged the tin on my own. So each print, once it's transferred on the tin, is one of a kind. And that's why I love this process, because it's super, super cool, because you never know what you're going to get. And the second you print it, it looks like beautiful. It looks like a commercial print, like a regular studio print. But then when you transfer it to the tin, the transparency pulls off, and it might pull some of the texture off. So then it becomes unique on its own.
Well, let's go back to the pronoun issue, because, well, it's an essential part of this conversation. Talk about the power that's he, she, them, there.
Yes.
Have you ever spent this much time thinking about what those words mean?
No. And that was probably my favorite part of this project, is really educating myself on what these individuals deal with on a daily basis.
It's obvious to me, anyway, when somebody goes by he and somebody goes by she. Can you help me out a little bit more with when they use they and them?
Yes. Okay, so from my understanding, the they pronoun is used when the individual doesn't go by a specific male or female. They inside feel they could be either gender, nor do they really even see gender. That's what, like, I had to wrap my brain around, is that gender doesn't necessarily exist. I mean, it obviously exists because we're born male or female, but to these individuals, they inside don't feel like they have a gender leaning more towards male than female.
Maybe something more of a duality, or perhaps more accurately, that there isn't a binary, it isn't just male and there isn't just female.
Correct.
It's more of a spectrum.
Right. Yes. Yes. From what I would understand, the particular individuals who go by the pronoun they, that's how they feel.
Did you ever feel like this isn't your story to tell?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, good question. Yes, I feel like I had the visual and I had the text that I know that I wanted to use. I had the look of how I wanted the portraits to be stylized, but it's not my plight. So I by meeting each 12 participants, I felt very much like I could tell their story through a single photograph, which isn't always the easiest thing to do. you know, because there's a lot of, that's the thing with pictures. You don't have necessarily the words. You feel it by looking at it. And that's what I hope everyone can see out of each piece.
When you go into a photo shoot, do you sort of go in where you just assume that you will see something in a person's personality that will absolutely determine the composure, the lighting, or what have you? Or do you go in saying, these pictures in particular, they're very arresting in the sense that the average size person is going to be eye level and staring someone in the eyes.
No, I didn't necessarily go into this photo shoot blind. I did not know what any of the participants looked like. The day that I photographed them was the day that I met them. That was very challenging, where like in celebrity photography, you see hundreds of pictures of celebrities of what they look like. And that's what my favorite thing about this series is that you see what you get. Now, when I was doing the pre-production of this show, I was thinking of going a completely different way. I originally come from a background where things are highly stylized. I lived in Las Vegas before here. Very highly stylized photo shoots where I had a hair and makeup stylist. I had prop stylists. We had food stylists if it was a food shoot to be included with portraiture. So I've worked with a team of people. So this is very dear to me because it was myself. I was the only photographer there. I set up all the lighting to do the studio lighting, but it was just me and the individual. There were no hair and makeup artists. It is them as they are. Before deciding of what to do with this, I was thinking about doing a very stylized shoot, and I'm glad I didn't go in that direction.
It's interesting that talking about celebrity photos, and this is going to sound meaner than I mean for it to sound, but you're talking about the hair, the makeup, the people blowing fans, and all of this work, and you end up oftentimes with a picture that doesn't say something you didn't already know. Now, here, you have just a stripped-down version, a person, and simple lighting, and it just allows the photos to speak so much more.
Right. And that's what I loved about this, too, is like the simplicity that came out of that, where, again, my background, things weren't done so simply, and now I've done something where I've stepped out of my comfort zone, and I love it, and I don't want to go back to that way of shooting anymore. I'm happy like shooting this way and really getting to know the individual or the subject that I'm photographing, and there's something to be said for that. Mm-hmm.
Have you gotten any blowback? It is a controversial subject.
Yeah, I haven't yet. I expect to. I definitely expect to, because I myself am not transgender. But I've tried very, very hard through all the pre-production to set it up to where this series is neutral and non-offensive. I hope that it's not. And that's why I, again, turn the terminology back to the individuals. I'm not, you know, an expert on transgender vocabulary.
Are you anticipating then the blowback more from the transgender community versus the cisgender community?
Both. I hope both. Yeah, that's where I think that this really could go either way. And I'm finding out, being like going into more of the fine art photography, that that's where I feel like I lie in many of the series that I create. I think it's important to do your research ahead of time, and instead of just going blindly in, which I originally did. I originally had this concept of what I thought it was going to look like. I thought it was going to be highly stylized, but then I talked to several individuals and found out that those individuals don't want to be photographed that way. They want to be just like everybody else in whatever the normal is. What is normal, you know? And that's what I learned by meeting each of these individuals, that they just want to be shown who they are inside and out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was definitely very struck by, you know, you see a lot of great photos for events around Pride Week, and you see people who are very flamboyantly dressed and very much saying, stop ignoring me, this is who I am, this is how I live. And I was really struck by how normal these photos are.
Right. Yeah, and what is normal, right? But yes. Well,
yes.
Yes, but yeah.
I mean, these look like high school yearbook photos.
Right. That's the other thing, and that's what's so, you know, the juxtaposition of that it's normal people in studio lighting. So it is stylized to a way through the lighting. We're not in an outside atmosphere. It is controlled lighting, but each of the subjects is photographed as is. And that's what I loved about it. You know? And then through text, which is, you know, again, the power of words and the usage of a date or a pronoun that really maybe identifies each individual. That's the only way you can tell that they're a transgender individual, you know, is through the text. Otherwise, you wouldn't know.
No, I absolutely would not have known.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why artist statements are important.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ashley Thornburg visiting with photographer Beverly Poppy about her photo exhibit of transgender people in North Dakota. TransNodak is at the Rourke in Moorhead and runs through mid-September. You can see Poppy's commercial work at BeverlyPoppy, that's PoPPE.com. The Minnesota Department of Education will help schools with transgender issues this year. The department will provide an 11-page document titled A Toolkit for Ensuring Safe and Supportive Schools for Transgender and Gender Nonconforming Students. The toolkit is a response to school requests for guidance in dealing with the growing number of students who are openly transgender. Eva Wood with Outfront Minnesota pushed hard for the guidelines.
We have an obligation to create safe and welcoming learning environments for them. So I think it absolutely helps, but it doesn't finish the goals. And, you know, the schools where trans kids tend to have more trouble are probably going to be the same schools that choose not to adopt it.
The guidelines summarize state and federal laws and discuss the use of pronouns, and also makes policy recommendations for student activities, dress codes, and locker rooms and bathrooms. The guidelines are optional. According to the most recent Minnesota student survey, about 2.5%, or more than 20,000 high school students in Minnesota, identify as transgender or gender diverse. Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Many people regard art as a luxury, but few acknowledge that it is old as humanity itself. On the next episode of Why, we're going to look at art from an evolutionary perspective and ask what purpose it served. So join me and my guest, Valerius Geist, for Why Did Homo Sapiens Evolve Into Artists? On the next Why Radio, Sunday, August 13th at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Isolation isn't just a complaint of rural life. It can be the root of a host of social and health problems. 7 years ago, three Catholic nuns converted a storefront in Concordia, Kansas, into a drop-in center to provide support and resources for young mothers in poverty. Their idea is spreading to the nearby town of Abilene. Brian Thompson reports for Harvest Public Media.
In her work as a mental health counselor in Abilene, Sister Loretta Jasper sees people struggling to cope with small-town life.
They don't have a safe or a healthy support system, or maybe they're very isolated, or maybe they don't have anyone who is really going to listen to them.
Some of the women she counsels have had children taken into state custody and are working to be reunited with them. Many are under orders to complete substance abuse or mental health treatment. But job responsibilities, child care conflicts, or lack of transportation can get in the way.
And if they can't do it, then they're automatically removed from continued services. When in fact, maybe what's best is they just need to be sitting in a room with other people with no expectations.
Jasper thought a drop-in center like the one in Concordia could provide them that kind of safe, welcoming place. She turned to Patty O'Malley, a stockbroker in Abilene, for help. A recovering alcoholic herself, O'Malley had previously founded a sober living house after her teenage son died in a car crash while he was struggling with addiction.
I think it was at that moment that I really came to the end of everything I knew. So when I lost my son, I felt like I had a choice. It was roll up in a ball and give up, or do something with all that love that I had for my son.
O'Malley says the need for connection is clear, not only among the women in the sober living program, but also among some of her clients at the brokerage firm.
I work with recent widows and recent widowers, and I see what happens very quickly, the loneliness, and sometimes the deterioration that happens with that loneliness.
Carrie Henning-Smith, a rural health researcher at the University of Minnesota, says the need for social connection is human nature.
And so finding ourselves in situations where there are not opportunities to meaningfully engage with other people is not how we've evolved to live.
And Henning-Smith says social isolation can be downright dangerous.
It can be as harmful to your health as smoking cigarettes, as being severely obese.
Suicide rates are higher in rural areas than in urban settings, due at least in part to isolation and loneliness. In fact, the most recent data from the CDC show that in counties with fewer than 50,000 residents, like Dickinson County, home to Abilene, the suicide rate is nearly double the average in counties with more than a million people. Abilene Police Chief Mike Moan sees it firsthand.
Whether or not it's isolated into women specifically, we do see on the suicide part of it over the last several years an increase in dealing with people that have concerns and problems.
Moan was among dozens of people who crowded onto the wraparound porch of a bright orange house near downtown Abilene in February.
Yeah, we're all going to get into picture wraparound. Go on.
As Sister Loretta Jasper, now director of the new drop-in center, cut the ribbon, a photographer took a picture.
Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Yay! Neighbor to Neighbor is already offering a daily free lunch and knitting classes, and the opportunities for human connection alone could be powerful. While hard to quantify, researcher Carrie Henning-Smith says the health benefits are real.
People in community presents opportunities for friends, for neighbors to say, hey, have you been to the doctor? Are you keeping up with your medication? I think it can impact mortality risk in ways that we can hardly even begin to understand.
The organizers of the drop-in center in Abilene are hopeful it might help prevent depression, substance abuse, or even suicide. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
Brian Thompson is part of the Kansas News Service, a collaboration covering health, education, and politics across that state. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about a group that calls itself the Bloodstained Men. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The expansion of a special library on the UND campus is now complete. As Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, it was completed under budget.
The library in question is the Wilson M. Laird Core and Sample Library. It's used by scientists and by the oil industry.
Companies are required when they drill a oil and gas well to provide us with both the cuttings or the samples. You know, as the drill bit grinds through the rock, they are collected at the surface. And then any core that they take, they're required to give us a representative copy.
State geologist Ed Murphy says the original library was built back in 1980, and it's been an important part of oil development.
Just one of the oil plays that Whiting Petroleum had come up with by studying core in the core library would pay for a new core library every 320 days.
Murphy says Whiting's study done in the core library led to the drilling of 217 oil wells in Billings and Stark counties, pre-Bakken. He says the library contains 85 miles of core and 150,000 boxes. There are 45,000 boxes of samples and hundreds of thousands of photographs. Murphy says along came the Bakken development, and the library started filling up.
It filled up much quicker than we anticipated.
So the 2015 legislature was asked for funding. Lawmakers gave the project $13.6 million. But Murphy says the final construction costs meant
we returned $331,962.92.
In addition to the storage area, five new laboratories were built. Murphy says there should be plenty of space for a while.
This one we built to hopefully get 50 to 60 years out before it fills up.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And State Game and Fish Department officials say despite a mild spring, North Dakota duck brood numbers are down slightly this year. Migratory Game Bird Management Supervisor Mike Szymanski says the mid-July survey says the number of broods counted per square mile came in at 3.68. He says that is down by 5% when compared to last year. Szymanski says though the brood count had declined, our mild spring may have helped support brood production.
You know, people see rainy, cool weather in May and they kind of think, wow, it's good ducky weather, but it's kind of tough on little fuzzy ducklings, and we didn't have so much of that. It could have contributed a little bit to, you know, our brood size, but we do know that not having a lot of cold, wet weather is helpful. To what extent, it's hard to measure, but we probably didn't have too much duckling mortality because of weather this year.
Szymanski says ongoing drought is also impacting habitat for the birds. He says seasonal basins have dried up and there is noticeable lowering in semi-permanent basins. With the lower water levels also bring concerns of water quality. Szymanski says without a good recharge over the winter months, it's uncertain how the basins will fare. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
A young boy abducted by Boko Haram manages to escape.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
You are fine, thank you.
And children like him have become a top priority for the Nigerian government.
If we cannot take care of them today, they will be the great monsters that are going to consume everybody.
A story of survival. Plus the latest on Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's tour of Southeast Asia on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chances are pretty good you've never given a second thought to circumcision. It's common in the United States, particularly where we live. A group of protesters wants that to change. The Bloodstained Men and their friends are wrapping up a 17-day tour that included five stops in North Dakota to protest circumcision. They call themselves Intactivists. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg spoke with David Atkinson, the CEO and co-director of the Bloodstained Men and their friends. And note, if you're listening with kids who aren't yet ready for medical terms, there are a lot of them in this interview.
David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
When did you become an intactivist?
That was probably about 3 years ago. I learned about foreskin 10 years ago when I was 19. And that's the first time I saw a picture of an intact human penis. And I immediately understood that the glands, the head of the penis, is supposed to be an internal organ. It's supposed to be warm and moist and protected all the time. So I spoke with my friends and family to warn them that if a doctor wants to cut off part of their child's penis, that they should not allow that. But it was only about 3 years ago when I attended the Genital Autonomy Symposium in Boulder, Colorado in 2014, when I learned a lot more about the foreskin and understood that foreskin amputation is far more destructive than I knew. And so I met many other intactivists at that symposium, and I started traveling with the Bloodstained Men that fall in 2014 in September.
When you say far more destructive, what do you mean?
The average adult foreskin has approximate surface area as this Bloodstained Men info card, this 3x5 card. And it's a double fold of skin, so if you fold it in half lengthwise and then wrap it around your fingers, then what you get is a replica of what would cover the head of the penis. The outer foreskin is basically an extension of the shaft skin, where the inner foreskin is a mucous membrane, like the inside of your lip or the inside of your eyelid. And then in between these two skin layers, you have the dartos fascia muscle tissue. It's the same muscle that's in the scrotum that responds to external temperature to bring the testicles closer to the body if it gets cold, for instance. And there are also lots of nerve pathways that terminate in Meissner's corpuscles. These are very fine-touch nerve receptors that exist in the ridged band in the tip of the foreskin. It's similar to the fingertips. You have ridges there and densely clustered nerve receptors as well. Also in your lips and in the clitoral hood. And so this entire structure is totally destroyed when it's amputated. And then the head of the penis becomes an external organ, which it's not supposed to be. It dries out. It gets covered with a layer of keratin, which is basically a callus, and because it rubs up against the underwear all the time. And so not only do you have desensitization caused by the amputation of nerve endings, what you have left in the glands is further desensitized. So it's very destructive for natural sexual function.
What about the advantages to it? There are some doctors and parents who would argue that it is easier to maintain a circumcised penis, that the rate of UTI, urinary tract infections, is lower among circumcised men. Into adulthood, the female partner of a circumcised male has a lower risk for cervical cancer. How do you respond to those arguments?
To the extent that intact young boys have a higher rate of urinary tract infections, we expect that that is due to forcible, premature foreskin retraction. In a young child, the foreskin is not retractable. Often it does not become retractable until puberty. And so when doctors tell you that you should forcibly retract the foreskin and wash underneath with soap, many doctors have been saying that for several decades, and it's a very damaging thing to do. It would be equivalent to opening up your daughter's genitals and washing them with soap. Mucous membranes do not need soap. Even in the adult, you don't need soap between your foreskin and your glands. You can just rinse with water. But when you do it to a child, you're breaking this connective membrane, the balanoprepucial lamina, and that will cause an open wound, and then you're much more likely to be infected. So there have been no studies of urinary tract infections in boys that account for this factor, whether or not the boys are being properly cared for, by which I mean left alone to develop normally, or whether or not their genitals are being tampered with. As to the question of cancer in potential female partners, I would say that it is a very despicable idea that we should amputate genital tissue from one person in order to benefit someone else, especially someone who might not even exist, because the boy might grow up and not have any partners, or might grow up and be gay. The primary obstacle faced by foreskin advocates in the United States today is the American Academy of Pediatrics, whose 2012 circumcision policy statement has been condemned by doctors from around the world because it totally ignores the sexual and protective functions of the foreskin, which are documented throughout the medical literature.
It's less common, certainly in Europe and I believe in South America too. Where it seems to be the most common is Middle Eastern countries, people still practicing an Islamic or Jewish traditions, and then in the U.S., and very specifically as you get into the north central part of the U.S. And I can't help but notice that the 17-day protest tour is really focused in that area as you're getting into North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska. Was that purposeful to choose this geographic location?
Yes, we try to reach all parts of the country because there are no communities in the U.S. where boys are protected from genital cutting. But we did want to reach the Midwest especially because the intact rate here is so low.
What's the response been so far on the tour?
We were in the Midwest 2 years ago in May 2015, and we received lots of heckles and middle fingers from passersby, and of course some support. Everywhere we go, we receive thumbs up and middle fingers, but in different proportions. When we were in the Midwest 2 years ago, the anger outnumbered the support. But now, 2 years later, we have received much more support because societal awareness is changing. And people are much more aware that foreskin is a normal, important, healthy part of the human body and that intactivism is not something to be mocked. So we still do receive angry people. We had several heckles, especially in Bismarck. We had an excellent day in Dickinson. In Dickinson, North Dakota, the local human rights activists came out to join us. The Dickinson Press was there. It was generally a friendly day. In Bismarck, it was a little bit angrier. And then in Minot, we had a very strange experience. As soon as we arrived, the police department came and they announced that they have a totally unconstitutional local ordinance which prohibits the holding of signs in the public sidewalks. And so we were told that we could protest on private property, which is very strange because that's the opposite of what we hear in most cities. So we went to private property, to a nearby hospital, and protested there. And then eventually they kicked us off. So we went to the U.S. Postal Service, the U.S. Post Office, and we thought, well, fine here because this is federal property. But they told us to leave as well. So we just traveled from place to place and then eventually finished our protest at 3 p.m. as scheduled.
Going back to talking about, you said you get heckled sometimes. You get maybe honked at, maybe flipped off, maybe worse, I'm not sure. But talking about hurt feelings, do you think a lot of that is because on many levels this is fighting tradition, this is fighting religious practices. This is something that you are going against, a deeply held religious belief. And in a lot of ways, that's harder to overcome than something that is strictly fact-based. Do you feel like that is part of the issue here with what you're trying to accomplish?
Religion certainly complicates things. In other parts of the world, in New Zealand, for instance, they used to do this. They used to cut the genitals of children just as much as we did in the United States in the early 1900s. And then the Health Ministry of New Zealand decided we're not going to do this anymore. And they did not have many religious groups there that were opposed to that idea, and so they just stopped doing it. So that is a factor. I think a lot of the anger in America comes for non-religious reasons. It comes because men are in denial about the damage caused by foreskin amputation. They have trouble coming to grips with the fact that part of their penis is missing, and so they lash out in anger at people who are sending them that message.
What are some of the risks of male circumcision?
The American Academy of Pediatrics statement in 2012, it claimed that the benefits outweigh the risks, but it only considered the risks of immediate surgical complications, such as bleeding or infection. Mm-hmm. It did not consider the harm inherent in loss of an important part of the penis. It did not give the foreskin any value. And so the risk of loss of that part of the penis is 100%. And it's very damaging to normal sexual function.
How so?
The foreskin acts as a rolling bearing during intercourse. And when the foreskin is not there, a lot of lubrication will get stuck behind the coronal ridge in the head of the penis, and it will get drawn out into the air every time the man comes out of his partner. And so very quickly you have dry, painful, bloody intercourse, which is not a problem when the penis is working the way it was designed, because the foreskin retracts as the man inserts his penis, and then it covers the head of the penis again on the way out, and so the lubrication stays inside. There's a huge market for artificial lubrication in pharmacies in the United States. They don't have this problem in Asia and Europe and South America, where the men are intact and their genitals are functioning the way they were designed. There's also an issue that many men without foreskins have, where at the moment they reach orgasm, they feel too much of a painful sensation and they immediately want to stop all movement. And this is because the glands contains neurons that are very sensitive to pain and temperature, whereas the foreskin contains these pleasure, fine touch nerve endings. And when the nerve pathways have been severed, they no longer connect to the inhibitory interneurons in the spinal cord, which turn off the painful sensation in the glands. So an intact man does not have this problem because he's feeling a lot of pleasure from his foreskin. But the man without the foreskin will experience what he perceives as too much pleasure, even though it's mostly a combination of pain and pleasure. And so this is why these men come and heckle us on the street, and they say, oh, if I had any more pleasure, I wouldn't be able to stand it. But they don't understand it's the wrong kind of sensation. What they're missing is this fine touch sensitivity, and what they have left is this painful sensation from the glands.
How do we know that?
There was a study in 1996 by John Taylor. He studied the foreskins of several corpses, and he took cross-sections and looked at the Meissner's corpuscles, these densely clustered nerve endings. He measured the existence of them, and throughout the medical literature, there are discussions of the functions of the foreskin.
You talked about bloody, the possibility for bloody interaction on a penis and the possible painful sensation at the end, at the climax mm-hmm. period. I've never heard anybody talk about this before. Obviously, I'm not a doctor, but I am an adult. Mm-hmm. I have had a lot of frank discussions with my adult female heterosexual friends. It seems curious that I've never really heard anybody talk about that before.
Well, people are often not inclined to talk about the problems that they have. We hear all the time, we hear adult women tell us, my son is circumcised and he's fine. And we respond to them, how could you possibly know? What son talks to his parent about his sex life? So your son could have all sorts of complications. Many people just think that sexual dysfunction is normal because that's all that they've ever known.
When it comes to genital cutting, certainly when it comes to male circumcision, male genital cutting, this is something that has been very common for centuries, and it has been very common across the globe. When it comes to females, definitely pockets of the world where it is practiced quite a bit more, and the side effects of female genital mutilation. We're talking about necrotizing fasciitis, endometriosis, tearing in the anal sphincter, the transmission of Hep B, Hep C, HIV. The vagina and the uterus can fill with menstrual blood. The complication rate among female genital mutilation is oftentimes fatal. Does the blood-stained men do any work in the broader community against genital mutilation across sexes?
We are totally opposed to the genital mutilation of any child. We focus our efforts on male genital mutilation and intersex genital mutilation because those are the children that are not protected in the United States, which is where we are operating. Intersex children are born with ambiguous genitals. It's not clear. They're somewhere on the spectrum between male and female. And often the doctors and the parents will get scared and they'll say, we have to make them conform to appearances that are more common. This is not a good idea to tamper with their genitals because, again, they are perfectly healthy. They do not need anyone cutting their genitals. They can decide for themselves how they want their genitals to function when they are adults. In very rare cases, there might be an intersex condition that requires treatment, but it is not common at all. So in the United States, we have, fortunately, a federal law that protects female children from genital cutting. And this is regardless of the motivations of the perpetrators. If they claim that they're doing it for religion or if they claim that they're doing it to benefit that child, it doesn't matter what they claim. It is a federal offense to cut the genitals of a girl. And the World Health Organization classifies four types of female genital mutilation. They range from clitoridectomy, where the external glands and foreskin of the clitoris are removed, to infibulation, where many things are removed and the vaginal opening is sewed up. And on the other end of the female genital cutting spectrum, they also include a ritual pinprick, or scraping, or cauterization, these things that do not amputate any sexual tissue but are still harmful. And all of that is totally illegal in the United States, which it should be. And some of those are more severe than amputation of the male foreskin, and some of them are less severe than amputation of the male foreskin. So the question is then, we have this 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution that's supposed to guarantee equal protection under the law. Why are some children being protected from genital cutting and others are not?
Do you feel like this is a conversation you need to be gearing more towards the medical community or more towards parents?
We're focused on educating parents because they are the decision makers right now. And it didn't always used to be that way. In the 1800s, whether or not a man got to keep his whole penis was decided by himself. And in the early 1900s, often the hospitals would just do it automatically. And so it was the hospital decision. But right now, we have this peculiar circumstance in the United States where the parent is making the decision whether or not the man gets to keep his whole penis. And because of this, we can make a lot of progress by educating the cross-section of American population, because anyone is equally likely as anyone else to be a parent.
Are you a parent?
I am not.
Do you plan to become one?
It might happen someday. I'm not certain. I have many nieces and nephews who I enjoy spending time with.
Yeah.
But I would say about the medical community, if the American medical community was going to stop cutting children's genitals on their own, they would have done it decades ago when the rest of the English-speaking world did, when Canada and the UK and Australia and New Zealand, who used to have very high rates of foreskin amputation, said, this is not wise, and the rates now are very low. But in America, we have a medical system that is subject to a lot of perverse incentives. Instead of incentivizing healthy patients, like they do in other parts of the world, the doctors are paid per procedure. And so they get paid every time they carry out a foreskin amputation, and so they continue doing it. Again, they don't want to acknowledge that they've been harming the genitals of children for 100 years, so it's easier to just claim that they should still be doing it.
Have you talked to your parents, frankly, about this?
Yes, I spoke
to
my parents.
Should I assume you're circumcised?
My foreskin was amputated when I was a child. I was too young to defend myself, and I would have preferred to keep my whole penis, including the natural lubrication and the retractable moving parts.
How do you talk to your parents about this?
I'm fortunate that my parents are very open-minded, and I just spoke to them. Even before I understood how a lot of other people don't want to talk about this, I just talked to them, and they did not have a problem. They said, yeah, we're sorry that that happened, and we did not know any better, and no one told us. And so I don't really blame them. But if I was being born right now, and all they would have had to do is Google functions of the foreskin and learn how important this body part is, and then they still had allowed that to happen to me, then it would be a different story. The children who are being born and cut right now, they're going to grow up and talk to their parents, and they're going to say, why did you not protect me? The information was all there, and their parents are not going to have an answer.
David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was David Atkinson, the CEO and co-director of the Bloodstained Men and Their Friends. There's considerable debate on this issue. On our Main Street Archive page, we have a link to a May 2016 New York Times article featuring Aaron E. Carroll, a professor of pediatrics at Indiana University School of Medicine. Dakota Datebook is next.
Before highways, there were trails. North Dakota has 10 scenic byways, and the longest one is the Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson. The drive features a slower pace off the interstate while enjoying the rolling hills of ranch and farmland or tracing the footprints of Custer's March West. Learn more about Old Highway 10 and Red Trail at oldredold10.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 7th, Remembering World War I. When Alexander Papelpeu obtained his homestead patent in Stark County on June 26, 1914, his future looked bright and promising. Having received his citizenship only 6 months before, he now decided it was time to return to his home country of Russia. Here he would take care of some business affairs and wed his sweetheart, who awaited him there. They would then return to his homestead. But his return would be an epic journey of war, deprivation, and diplomacy. Only 4 days prior to the happy couple's departure for the United States, Austria declared war on Serbia. Russia began drafting an army, and Alexander was conscripted to serve. Having lost his naturalization record on the trip over, he had no proof that he was an American citizen, and therefore found himself in the Russian army. His young bride, who had been wrestled from her husband's side after a 3-day honeymoon, was forced to continue the journey to her new home alone. On September 24th, the Russian Third Army began the siege of the fortress city of Chemosol on the River San. Lacking sufficient artillery, the commander ordered a full-scale assault on the fortress. For 3 days, the Russians attacked and accomplished nothing at the cost of 40,000 casualties. Alexander was one of 5,000 soldiers left behind to cover the Russian withdrawal and was captured by the German army. As a German prisoner, he watched as his fellow comrades died of starvation and exhaustion from forced labor. His fortune changed when he was taken to an Austrian prison camp where he fared much better. With better food and more humane treatment, he managed to survive another 17 months working for the local farmers and businessmen. As the months went by, his young bride, Julia, lobbied tirelessly to obtain his freedom based on his American citizenship. Through the efforts of Patrick Norton, North Dakota's congressman from Hedinger, they were finally able to petition for his release through diplomatic wire pulling. In March of 1917, Alexander was granted safe passage to Switzerland, and from there he made his way to France, arriving just as the United States declared war on Germany. Alexander Papel Pugh returned to his farm 14 miles south of Dickinson. On this date in 1917, he was enjoying a reunion with his young bride, who for almost 3 years feared that she would never see her husband again. Theirs was an odyssey unlike many who came from their home country, but for them it would remain a vivid realization of their freedom in America. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Tuesday on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith will join us live in the studio. With much of the state coping with drought, it's a challenging growing season. And if you have a question, help will just be a phone call away on Tuesday. You can call us live during the show, or you can email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org right now. We hope you'll join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.